healthcare in America is very expensive and very elusive to certain populations. And that tension is really complicated. We live in a country where health is being sold to us using the same language and the same techniques as fashion. It's branded. Our own bodies are being branded and sold back to us.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. From the outside, the wellness industry looks like a really promising path to thinking more holistically about health, pushing whole foods, self-care, body positivity, and mindfulness. Whole foods become packaged supplements, self-care twists into a perceived brokenness, and mindfulness achieved through expensive memberships. And like fashion, it's made a capitalistic shift into selling exclusivity at a high cost. Amy LaRocca spent almost two decades covering the fashion industry for New York Magazine before turning her attention to the recent wellness boom. She joined me at Aspen Ideas Health to talk about her new book, How to Be Well. And together we try to make sense of this often predatory $6 trillion industry. So please welcome Amy LaRocca to The Other 80. Welcome to The Other 80. I'm delighted to have you on. I must say, you are hilarious.
Oh, thank you.
And I just really appreciate your humor. There's too little of it in the healthcare
industry. In wellness,
industry, yeah. And in wellness in general. I wanted to have you set up the bones of your book and of the work that you've done, and especially the connection that you've seen as a former fashion journalist between fashion and wellness. My audience is a lot of health policy geeks, people who are CEOs of companies, and it would help to have you give a definition of wellness, kind of, and then also talk about that connection you see and the threads you saw drawn between fashion and wellness and how they operate.
So my background is as a journalist and then more specifically as a fashion journalist. I worked at New York Magazine for 20 years and I did work at Vogue before that. But at New York Magazine, I wasn't really of the fashion industry in a way you are when you're at Vogue, but you're covering the fashion industry. And I realized what really interested me was how people wanted things, and not only wanted, but wanted to elevate their lives through fashion, wanted to communicate things about themselves to other people through fashion. And I was very interested in aspiration, yearning, want, branding, marketing, what we were being told about ourselves as women through the clothes we bought and the accessories we carried, and what we did on a daily basis to elevate ourselves out of the mundanity and the banality of life. And that was what I liked about fashion, that you could use it for all these different things. What I didn't like about fashion was feeling exploited, feeling taken advantage of. So I always had a kind of push-pull relationship with it, with the industry, where I both loved it and resented it and had a lot of contradictory feelings about it, as I do about most things in life. You might find that theme coming up. I'm not all in or all out on anything. So I noticed a couple of things about fashion in the time I covered it. One of them was that it started to become very democratic. Not very democratic, it's still very expensive, but it certainly became more democratic. And one of the things people really liked, love-hated, about fashion was its exclusivity. It was hard to get it. It was hard to access it. Fashion shows happened in very small rooms with very few people. To go to a fashion show was really something special. And you would get dressed up and you would go into these little rooms and you had to be invited. And then no one really knew what you saw in that room until months later when it might appear in a magazine. Then no one could really touch it until months after that. And then you had to be in certain stores in certain cities. And that gave it this kind of allure and mystique. But then you could buy these clothes online and have them delivered anywhere. And then suddenly you could stream these shows and you could be like, you know, in your nasty bathrobe, right? Like sitting in your basement, or you could be on the toilet live streaming the Prada show straight from Milan if you wanted, right? And so suddenly everyone knew, right? Everyone had an opinion on what Miuccia was doing that season. And they could see it at the same time as the fashion editor in Milan. And they could buy it and they could have it delivered to them at home within 24 hours. And it just didn't seem that glamorous anymore once it was accessible. So the fashion people started looking elsewhere. They started looking to wellness, which was harder to get and a little more exclusive. And you knew this doctor, or you knew this diet, or you knew this regime. And that started to get a certain allure. Now, of course, the flip side of that is quite dark, which is that healthcare in America is very expensive and very elusive to certain populations. So that's the kind of twisted underside of it. And that tension is really complicated. And I just got really, really, really interested in all of it. I got really interested in the idea that we live in a country where health is being sold to us using the same language and the same techniques as fashion. It's branded. Our own bodies are being branded and sold back to us. It's very weird. It's very strange.
In the scoping in the book, you talk about everything from yoga to breath exercises to functional medicine. What are they? Colonics.
Oh, yeah.
Microdosing various things and supplements, things that might treat your skin in different ways. I think functional medicine is probably the one that gets closest to what we think of as clinical medicine. And I think you did a beautiful job of also talking about the people and brands behind these and how it's that sense of mystery of the body and mystery of the exclusivity that really is appealing to people.
It really is. I think it's the idea that these other people hold these secrets and that you can, if you're determined enough and if you spend enough, you can get them. But I think that's not new. I think this idea of these fountains of youth and these secret keepers has been around for a really long time, and that you could access them in revival tents or with these gurus and these shamans has been around for a really long time. And I think they kind of repackage and come back to us at different points in history. And that's something I really was interested in looking at. When do these ideas swell and when do they sort of recede? They never go away entirely, but definitely there's different points in societies and different points in culture where we are more susceptible to thinking about things like purity, like toxicity, when we become more frightened of the outside world and is it poisoning us? When we become more fixated on these notions, they never go away entirely, but we do get more and less fixated on them at different times.
One of the threads you pull on a little bit, but I'd love to have you talk about more, are the both tensions and similarities between the Make America Healthy Again movement, MAHA, and the wellness movement. What do you see as the tensions between those two?
Yeah.
And also where they really are treading the same ground?
Well, one of the things that I find really interesting about this is in a lot of cases in this book, I try to look at historical precedent. You can't talk about wellness in America right now without looking at Germany in the 1930s. Because we're hearing a lot of the same language and we're hearing a lot of the same ideas that were very popular in Germany in the 1930s. You are even seeing the reopening of some of the spas that started in the 1930s in Germany and in Austria, and you are seeing them being opened by some large hotel conglomerates. They're on lakes, and you get a big great robe, and you can lay out in the chairs and get this method and that method and swirl around in a bath. And a lot of the language is very similar. You have purity. You have toxicity. So then you start thinking a little bit, okay, well, what was going on in Germany? You had a fear of outsiders. You had an industrial revolution that was changing the way that people were living and frightening people. You had people moving away from their families and going to live in the city. So a move away from an agrarian lifestyle to an industrial lifestyle. What do we have now in America? You have this tech lifestyle that is changing the way people live. So instead of a more social lifestyle, people are inside. So they're not outside in the air, they're inside on their screens. So again, it's a shift in lifestyle to something that feels less quote-unquote natural. You have different reactions to this. You have one reaction that's very so-called right. You have one reaction that's very left. But again, you're having a fear of something from the outside. You're having a fear of something perceived as natural being replaced with something so-called false, so-called unnatural, something modern, change. In Germany, it was the Volkisch movement, back to the land, Lebensreform. And you had people on the, let's call it the left, become nature boys. Some of them came to America. They brought these like little loaves of bread, you know, that super dense bread. Still can get it. They started health food stores in California. You had some Volkisch Lebensreformers stay in Germany and become members of the Nazi Party. So you can kind of see how these back to the land, nature, purity, toxicity movements can push you in different directions. When I start thinking about the Maha movement and wellness, and I take a look at the supplements that, say, Alex Jones was selling when he had a website, and I look at what's in, say, Moon Juice Super U, and then what was in Super Male Vitality that was available on InfoWars with a bald eagle on it, and you could just like sort of hear the like, caw-caw, when you saw it, and it was ashwagandha in both of them, and it was these things that like gave you the sense that the outside world was dangerous and you were going to require some sort of protection from it. How you defined that danger was, you know, very different, but you agreed on the idea that there was a danger. So like, is the danger COVID or is the danger the vaccine?
That's so interesting. And I think I kept on coming back to this contradiction in when I read your book, which was, I think, especially in Maha, there's a suspicion of science as having been taken over by moneyed interests and being conflicted and not being serious enough. And how do we know these vaccines are safe? And just this sense of like, I really want to control what I put in my body. And like,
well,
I'm not sure about all this, right?
Libertarian, like I want control, right?
And then on the other hand, some of those same people are ascribing to wellness trends that have no scientific backing. And I just had a really hard time reconciling those two things.
Like, it's really hard to reconcile. I mean, we were talking about this with supplements, right? Like, you won't take a medication, but you'll take a supplement. Like, you won't take something that was vetted for years by scientists and doctors, but you'll gobble down supplements that aren't vetted by anyone.
Your story of going to the functional medicine in Manhattan and getting a B12 shot before you even knew you were getting it.
I was like, what is that?
Yeah, that happened to me. I was in the Peace Corps and I was going into the doctor's office because my roommate was vegetarian. I wanted to get her B12 pills. And he was like, sorry, the pills don't work, but it's a shot. And he gave me the shot.
You're like, oh, what have you done?
I did feel good for a couple of days, but
like an hour.
Yeah, exactly. The basis of this podcast is the concept that 80% of our health is created by things that are not medicine.
Yes.
The food we eat, the stress in our lives, our family relationships, our communities, these things. Conceptually, wellness should be a step towards a more holistic way to look at health, right? Where does it get off track? And what would be a step in the right direction?
I mean, it sounds really simplistic to say, but I think it gets off track when people start trying to make money. And it's a pretty basic thing to say, I'm aware, but we can talk about all the moments when it goes off track, because I fundamentally think a lot of people who get started in wellness have good ideas, right? The functional medicine doctors are like, I think that we should start treating the patient holistically and we should think about the cause of the disease, root causes, rather than just like fixing what's wrong and then sending them on their way. And then they'll be back in a month when it goes wrong again. Like, it's a great idea. I have no, you have an objection.
I've got no objection.
No problem with that, right? But then suddenly they're selling you nasty protein powder. And you're like, wait, what does that have to do with the thing you said before? Because I want to go back to that.
Actually, that was much better. The food was
Can we go back to that before you started like selling me magnesium pills that I don't want? Gave me a stone cake. But so I think that these things sort of get derailed because there's too much of a profit motive in medicine and medicine adjacent stuff in this country. And really, that's the problem, is that we have a very confused idea about how we think about medicine.
You know, I think the things I really agree with the Maha movement is that same fact, is the fact that we're not investing in prevention. We're not investing in whole foods or food systems. We're investing in medicine. There are conflicts. I agree with all of that. It just then confuses some of the directions.
Then it goes wild where you're like, yeah, and I think that's what happens. Like all of a sudden you'll be like, yeah, I don't know why food dye is necessary. Then you're like, wait a second, get the vaccine back in here.
Yeah, exactly.
I was only like on board for the red dye.
Exactly.
Like, what are you doing?
Not for like COVID vaccine for pregnant women.
Yeah,
please.
Like where did get that measles vaccine back in here. So things just get really derailed really fast. So it's a problem we as humans have, right? Like we love the narrative. So it's like if the story's a little bit boring, we lose interest right away. A lot of medical stories are really dull.
I was intrigued that one of the strongest themes in the questions at the talk you just gave here at Aspen Ideas Health was, okay, fine, wellness has all these problems, but how do we use these techniques to actually sell the good science? I was not expecting that at all, because I think they're all feeling like we don't even know how to do this. We want some of that. We want
to tell the good stories.
Yeah.
And I think over and over and over again, you have really smart people just being like, how are we going to distill these complicated truths into the Oprah Winfrey stories? Someone asked me to write a piece about why does Oprah keep creating monsters? And I think it's because no one can resist a story. And a good story in medicine requires simplifying. And that is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you remember when she went to like John of God and Brazil?
It's
like she's watching this guy literally just do these crazy things. Of course, they're not true, but it's such compelling television.
And often involves someone in great distress who is very needy,
saved,
who is saved.
And it's beautiful story and it's so moving. And it's anyone who's ever been through a complicated medical journey with someone they love is like, wait, why isn't the recovery just a beautiful straight upward line? And it's like, no, because recovery is like up and it's down and it's sideways and it's this and it's that. We all want that beautiful straight line. And good television are these upward, beautiful redemption stories.
Mm-hmm. And the flawless skin. Are you familiar with the Nocturnist podcast?
No,
it's an amazing podcast. It came first out of the COVID experience of clinicians as having these really harrowing experiences that nobody else who weren't on the front lines with them knew about, which is actually interestingly echoed in The Pit right now.
The Pit.
Right?
The Pit.
That, all the flashbacks and things like that.
I didn't
that.
Sleep three nights.
I
Did
have the
sleep.
Same problem.
Yeah.
Don't tell me because I haven't finished the season.
I mean, how are you even here right now?
I know. How am I here? Let me go. So their latest series right now is on uncertainty in medicine and story after story of people, and you talk about this a lot in your book, who turn to alternative treatments out of a complete failure of the Western medical system to either provide answers or even to listen.
Yeah.
That they have, as you say, no other choice but to seek out these other things. And so the question I was starting to ask myself is, what would a framework look like that allowed people to be attended to and listened and experiment with things that maybe weren't traditionally recognized, and not just have this black and white of having to go off in the wild, wild west and try these things because the typical system wasn't hearing them. And that often those are also conditions that affect women more than men. Not always.
Right. Well, because historically, conditions that affect women have not been researched with the same fervor as conditions that affect men. So you're just not going to have the kind of depth of options and depth of care that men have. And of course, until recently, that gap was being slowly closed, but who knows about now. I think really what helps is taking a less sort of binary approach. And again, this would come back to like if functional medicine was practiced the way it is described on a pure level, which is that it doesn't have to be all one or all another. And I think you're always hearing these kind of nightmare stories about this person or that person who got cancer and said, no, I refuse chemotherapy and I'm only going to do yoga or whatever it is. And I think what you would have is ultimately a more hybrid approach in which you say, like, I'm going to have the best that Western medicine can offer. I will also simultaneously pursue things that might make me feel better on other levels. So it'd be like a more simultaneous approach.
Yes, but it also, I think, needs bridges between them, which I think could be provided by a single clinician.
Absolutely.
And you have like NIH, you have Mayo having integrative medicine components.
That's right.
But they're often sort of shunted to the side and a little bit ignored.
Right. So I think what you would want ultimately is a less binary position. And I think, again, in the book, I really went back to understand how we got into this situation. And of course, it's all based on the work of this man called Abraham Flexner. Andrew Carnegie realized that American medical schools had fallen way behind European medical schools, and he commissioned this researcher named Abraham Flexner to research why are American medical schools way behind European medical schools. And the result was hygiene was really bad in America. All for that. Yes, Abraham Flexner, thank you. Thanks,
John Snow, liked him too.
Thanks for the hygiene. All in favor. But that he really was like, I only want data. I want data, 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 data. So everything had to be data-driven. And if it didn't have very hard data results, Flexner shut it down. So before Abraham Flexner, there was more tolerance for other things that might now be considered alternative. But after the Flexner report, they were all thrown out. I mean, there were other complications. He also closed all Black medical schools except three. And at that point, medical schools weren't integrated. So there were only three medical schools that survived the Flexner report. So a lot of what we have considered mainstream medical education in America is based on this one report that was issued, you know, by the Carnegie Foundation almost 100 years ago and has never really had a kind of systemic relook.
One of my recent guests writes about loneliness and social connection. And I've been also following the work of folks that talk about the decrease in our joining of things, clubs, churches, and the decrease in our social connections. And the stats are pretty horrifying in 1 in 5 people being lonely, and young people, but also old people. One of the sections of your book really talks about these kind of sanctuaries. And you talk a lot about SoulCycle, but there are other examples, these places where people come together. There's a sense of social connection, a sense of support and mentorship, almost to the extent that they feel like church. And they often use that symbology as well. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
And do you feel like those are really serving an important role in connecting us?
I'll start from the beginning and get to that question. It's no question that since the end of World War II, it's been an almost annual decrease. Like every year you can count less Americans who consider themselves religious. And by religious, I don't mean spiritual, because there's more and more Americans who describe themselves as spiritual but not religious. It's even a search term on some dating sites. SBNR, spiritual but not religious, is a search term on a dating site.
I would probably consider myself that. And what the heck is that?
Right? Like I have a soul?
I don't know what that is.
Yeah. I don't know what that is either. But like, you know, even my parents who are like total secular atheists grew up with affiliation. We have no religion in our family, but they had affiliations to my mother to a temple and my father to a Roman Catholic church. And they would have never even thought about having that. So even in my own family of very non-religious people, my parents grew up with the affiliation and we grew up with no affiliation. So even in my own family, I can see it happening. It would never occur to my brothers and I to even sort of tell people what if we had a religion, whereas my parents would say I was raised Jewish, I was raised Catholic. And I think that's not uncommon. I think that's absolutely the sort of story of the century. And I mean, I know it is. The data would tell
right,
you.
Right.
So I think that people miss, if not the religion, a number of the things that come along with a religion, community, ritual, coming together, the support systems provided in times of crisis, the casseroles, right? And so I think you also have people living further from their families than in other generations and looking for spaces that replicate some of those lost and missing elements. And weirdly, sometimes those spaces are filled with exercise studios. People also love to multitask, right? So if you look at what happens in a ritual religious gathering, you see a lot of that replicated in a lot of these boutique fitness settings. You have ritual, you have music, you have ecstatic movement, you have charismatic leaders, you have a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
And these sermons have increasingly moved away from talk of muffin tops and bikini bodies and losing that whatever it is to kindness, community, thinking about your place in the world, thinking about taking the energy that you are building up in that room and spreading it forward. What I think about them as adequate replacement. I know that's probably very upsetting to people who have, I know it is. I've heard in readings and book talks that I've given that people who do have serious religious affiliations and lives find it offensive. But I also know that for lonely people, it's a meaningful place. And so I would maybe resist the idea that it's offensive because I resist the idea that someone who finds meaning in community needs to apologize for finding it.
The barrier to entering the exercise class, especially with mind, body, and like class pass, is so low
yeah.
compared to entering a spiritual house
yeah.
with knowing nobody there. And so I also think that brings interesting lessons about how to lower the barriers
of these
that's
very true. I hadn't thought about
joining
that.
Activities. Mm-hmm. Or even like Meetup did the same thing with hiking. When I moved to the Bay, it was super easy to go on hiking trips with other people.
Yeah, Meetup
because
running
suddenly,
clubs.
Right, there were these places you could go and you knew what the formula was and how to join. And,
yeah, I hadn't thought about that barrier to entry it being quite low. Some of these places will say like, okay, you know, we're in the studio now, but we're going to have a meetup at this other place that's outside the studio, and then we're all going to go for drinks. So it can be a real way to foster community. I definitely know that people describe it as church. People just yeah. call Sunday class Sunday service.
Yeah. Made me want to go to a Soul Cycle class, I have to say.
Yeah?
And I lived in D.C. when, of course, Michelle Obama was going.
Oh, and she was going. Well, like, listen, yeah, if you come yeah. to New York, you'll
okay.
you come to Lamar.
It's yeah. a date.
Next
Do you still go?
Oh, yeah, I still okay. go. Tuesdays and Fridays. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I have never really used it in that way. But I appreciate that it's there. And I appreciate the kindness. I really do. And I appreciate the switch from being told about my body. Because when I started going to the gym after college, rite of passage, young urban woman, you went to the gym. That was what part of your sort of thing. You have a job, you go to the gym. And it was all bikini season is coming. You gotta. I would much rather hear some mumbo jumbo about be nice than be told I had a muffin top, wouldn't you?
Yes, totally. yeah. Regardless of whether I did, you know.
Yeah.
There was a section of your book that I found myself arguing about, and I think it's because of a personal experience.
Yes, my tell me.
Older son, almost ordained as a Buddhist monk, did not. And now is studying social work, but is a very serious practitioner, and I think he would consider himself a Buddhist. So I think you point out that these ancient practices, yoga, meditation, breath work, have evidence and have incredible value for our health, but have been commoditized.
Yeah.
So it made me kind of want to almost parse like, well, these ones are actually fine and these ones aren't. But I think what you were describing, and it came more clear for me in this last session, it's not that the thing itself is bad. In fact, it could be quite beneficial. It's the capitalist overlay on this thing.
Have you read a book called McMindfulness?
No.
Oh, you should read McMindfulness. It's really, really, really interesting. And it's by a practicing Buddhist. And his objection is the use of these practices for the advancement of capitalist goals. That these practices are being used for something that they are inherently opposed to. And that he can't reconcile.
Like human performance for the startup founder who did the meditation. Whereas like I am actually part of a weekly sangha. I don't consider myself Buddhist, but our Rinpoche is always saying, it's not the meditation, it's whether you're actually improving the lives of other people.
That's right.
And so
that's improving the lives of other people. But what the McMindfulness, Ronald Purser is his name, I think he's also in the Bay Area.
Okay, I'm going to go look him up.
Yeah, you got to go look him up. Is that it is inherently contradictory to say, like, we are going to meditate and then we're going to go, like, kill it on the trading floor. Like,
right.
That the idea that Silicon Valley has taken up mindfulness as a performance enhancer.
Yes.
Rather than a tool of compassion is fundamentally against itself. Like, that it's just he can't reconcile the use of mindfulness as a capitalist tool, basically.
And I think a lot of the threads that you follow, functional medicine would be an example, where that concept does respond to this uncertainty in medicine, right?
Yeah.
And the ability to merge that flexionarian approach with other approaches, but somehow we get tripped up over and over again. And I don't know what the fix to that is.
Well, there's a lot of, and I think as we said at the beginning, like, there's a lot of love and hate in here. Like, I don't have a lot of answers, unfortunately. Yeah. If you were looking for the revival tent answer, you gotta look somewhere else.
I don't have those answers for you.
Look, with wellness, it's very important to me in this book that no one feel bad about anything that they do. You gotta just feel okay. Like Will Ferrell in Elf, when he goes by the coffee shop and he's like, oh my God, the world's best coffee. Like, I'll get an email and it'll be like, wellness tip to make you feel amazing. And I'm like, here it is. I got it. And then I'm like, oh, it just says I should get like lash extensions.
Which might be fine.
Okay. Maybe it'll be the next email. And exactly. I'll be like, here it is. Here the it wellness is. Tip.
Although you did end the book with a breathwork exercise.
I did.
Which I thought was.
Yeah.
Was,
and it does. Yeah. It really helps me calm down, that breathwork exercise. It really does help me calm down. And no way am I above any of it. I mean, really, like one day I spent like all day, I was like doing all my like collagen reading, like, oh God, it can't, like your body can't absorb the molecule. Wow. Then I was like, I think I'm going to buy this collagen. So I will do any of it, you know?
One of the probably most hilarious, but also a little frightening things you talk about is the longevity movement, which in contrast to the broader wellness movement, is really about guys wanting to live forever.
I know.
And
why?
On stage, you were talking about the two models. Could you share a little bit about that?
So it was like these like robots and then the meat puppets. And the meat puppets want to like live in their bodies forever. So just like keep them going. And then there's the putting your consciousness in the cloud and then beaming it into some sort of robotic avatar.
I mean, you could be dead. Your body would be
your
dead.
Your body would be dead, but your consciousness would be some AI version of your consciousness would be in the cloud and beamed into an AI avatar. And the most well-known version of that is Martine Rothblatt, who has created an AI avatar of her wife, Bina, and she's on Bina 4. The last time I really—
Wait, why would there have to be more than one?
Because she updates it.
Oh, got it.
So the last time I really like checked on Bina, it was—
Wait,
like,
is she the pharma woman?
Yeah, the pharma woman.
Oh my gosh,
woman.
I've met her. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
she's amazing.
Totally amazing. So that's like one version. But then there's the Dave Asprey version, who's the bulletproof coffee guy who says he sort of invented biohacking. He's got some whole other version of it where he's going to be in his own body and so is his wife. But also, and he said he was going to like carry another round of kids like in his own body when he's in his 80s. So I don't know what he's up to. Also, his wife, by the way, is an OBGYN. I don't know what you guys have cooking.
What are you guys doing? This sounds horrible.
I don't know what they're up to, but yeah.
I don't care how many energy drinks you have. If you're 80,
nootropics,
you do not want
you're
children.
Like smuggling across the Canadian border. I don't know what's
and there's
happening.
Also,
well,
so
it's interesting
kind of
to me. Like
to
a
me.
Lot of the gender stuff in researching this book is very interesting to me. Most wellness protocols have typically found their customer base to be like 80-20 female male. Very typical of like beauty industry. It's followed a lot of the trajectories of the beauty industry. Of course, women are also very responsible for like the medical choices in the household, right? Where children are concerned, because women, of course, do handle most of the labor where children are concerned. So women have also done a lot of the alternative seeking for all the reasons we were talking about earlier. So a lot of it makes sense to me that the consumer would be more female. With all the biohacking and the longevity, very male. Like
very
that
male.
Interest in living forever has really found a much more receptive audience in men.
And I wonder, I don't know, but I wonder how it relates to the moving to Mars thing too.
I don't really know. Maybe all those meat puppets
we'll
can go
to
Mars.
Like that. Well, it was such a pleasure to have you on,
so
and it was very
to
fun
here.
To meet you and hear you, and you're very funny.
Oh, thank
Everyone
you.
Everyone should read. It's a fun read. I sat down over the last couple of days and just had a blast and laughed out loud.
Oh, thank you
many
so
times.
Much.
But also, it's dealing with serious stuff around how we actually do create health
thank
as we move forward.
Thank you so much.
So thank you. Obviously, the parallels to 1930s Germany are deeply troubling. The obsession with nature, the drive to ban things considered toxic, the fixation on purity and blonde-haired beauty, they all echo chillingly familiar themes. Amy argues that the rise of Nazism was fed by fear and a sense of displacement, and we are certainly living with those tensions now. In Germany, people were moving from an agrarian to a more isolated industrialized society. Today, it's digital atomization and longing for the way things used to be, back to a time when women stayed home and families had two parents and lots of children. And you know, it's tempting to turn away from the discomfort of that, to keep scrolling, to say it's not our problem, to pretend it's fringe thinking. But instead, let's discover how to feel whole and vibrant without calling on brokenness, exclusion, and commoditization. We have to ask ourselves what the discomfort is telling us and then make a new path forward. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Amy LaRocca and her book. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time. I'm Claudia Williams.